Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic is Common Objections to Capitalism, Part 2. This is going to be a very interesting show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun as well. First, we have our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell, with us today. How are you today, Zoe?
Good, thank you.
I'm glad you're there. Okay, and Dr. Art Cardin. Welcome back, Art.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Good. Folks, Art is a professor of economics at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He is also a visiting scholar at a number of institutions, including the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And those of you who heard our show with Art from December 5th, 2009, will remember that we talked about the common objections of capitalism, and we dubbed that show Part 1 because we couldn't finish all the topics that we wanted to go over. Today we're going to continue with that conversation. So, Art, let's clarify what we mean by capitalism, first of all. You know, what folks see is a mixture of government intervention markets where things are all goofed up, such as in healthcare, and what we could call more free market segments, such as in LASIK surgery, plastic surgery, electronics, and so on, where we see prices actually going down and choices going up, quite the opposite of where government intervenes in markets. How can folks keep this straight?
Well, last time we defined capitalism in part by what it was not. So capitalism is not vice incarnate, again, to use a phrase from Deirdre McCluskey, and it's not greed is good. Capitalism, which is kind of an unfortunate term because it's not perfectly descriptive, but it's a system based on private property and voluntary exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to think of ways that you can separate something that is the free market from something that is intervention is by asking a couple of questions. Ask, do you need a license to do it? Is it subsidized? Are the rules being written by the government? You have to do a lot of reporting to the government. And in a lot of the cases that you mentioned, where there's a lot of innovation and where we have a great deal of dynamism, the government just hasn't caught up. And in the cases where, in the cases you mentioned,
that's a depressing definition.
Well, yeah.
The government has just not caught up.
Well, a friend of mine put it this way. Economists refer to the seeking of special privileges from governments as rent seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And so my friend Mike Hanek, who taught economics at Rhodes for a little while, wrote about medical marijuana dispensaries in California and said, you know they're here to stay when they start rent seeking.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who run the medical marijuana dispensaries were looking for government regulation.
Yeah, we've heard this term rent seeking before. Most people, understand it better when it's defined as privilege seeking.
Right.
When they're trying to actually harness the force of government to actually get what they want.
So remember a couple of years ago when Ted Stevens compared the internet to a series of tubes. You know, this was when I mentioned the government not catching up. You know, this wasn't just some guy; he was in charge of the regulatory apparatus that was supposed to navigate electronic commerce and all of this frontier stuff. So.
Okay, so let's go back to our show on December 5th, and let's recap with this first very common objection to capitalism, that capitalism exploits the poor. What's wrong with this objection?
Well, like I said last time, the main problem with the objection is that it's wrong, that it's not true. If anything, free markets have redounded primarily to the benefit of the poor. Everybody's gotten richer, but the poor have gotten richer much more rapidly than the rich. If you look at the major aspects of economic innovation in the 19th century, the 20th century, most of the benefits have gone to the poor. Most of the benefits have gone to the middle class.
Okay. We're going to come back to this particular point, and then we're going to expand beyond it when we come back after our break. So, folks, please stay with us. We have Dr. Art Cardin. We're talking about common objections to capitalism. You're listening to Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. We'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. And we're back, folks. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we have today Dr. Art Cardin and our special commentator, Zoe Russell, with us. And, Art, you were just addressing the issue of does capitalism exploit the poor and what was wrong with this particular objection. So please continue.
Yeah, well, one thing is, like I mentioned, it's not correct, in part because most of the benefits of capitalist change have gone to the poor and have created the middle class. So, for example, 100 years ago, 500 years ago even, if I was very, very, very wealthy, and if I wanted to read at night, I could use candles, or I could either pay or force some flunky to stand there and hold a torch.
Mm-hmm.
Today, and if I was poor, I didn't have that option.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, actually, there's a Johnny Cash song that includes a lyric in which the character is going to bed early because a jug of coal oil costs a dime.
Right.
And he's going to stay up late come picking time. So when he picks the cotton, he's going to have money so he can buy coal oil and stay up late. And I was thinking about this the other evening when I was reading by lamplight, and just how we absolutely take that for granted. But that's an innovation in large part of modern capitalist prosperity that today everybody just takes for granted, but that was the luxury of the super wealthy several centuries ago.
You brought an interesting point just a minute ago when you said that the actual beneficiary was this expanding middle class.
Right.
I don't think people really appreciate just how small a quote-unquote middle class was and just how large middle class is today. In other words, the rich didn't become poorer per se. The
right.
poor became richer, and they became the middle class. How
right.
big of an
right.
expansion was that?
It was enormous. It was absolutely enormous. Friedrich Hayek points this out in his essay on Capitalism and the Historians. When he says, effectively, for the better part of history, you had people who were very, very rich and people who were on the verge of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in the last roughly two and a half centuries, you've seen the creation of a group of people who are somewhere between fabulously wealthy and the brink of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a relatively modern capitalist innovation.
And that I think is a most underappreciated concept, because even the comforts, like you mentioned, light, but heat, refrigeration, communication, entertainment, mobility, transportability, all were not available to only but a very few people.
Right. Right. Certainly. And today there are things that we all take for granted.
We all take it for granted. Okay. So let's go into this other objection that we hear of capitalism, that it deadens the soul. In some way, that it makes us less human. What's wrong with this?
Well, again, I don't think it's necessarily true. When you look at criticisms of the capitalist economy that have emerged over the last couple of hundred years, or as originating in large part in Marx, there was an idea that, well, capitalism and free markets are going to underproduce wealth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not as efficient as socialism, which will produce superabundance. It's not gonna produce all of the wonderful stuff that we'd like to see, and it's going to keep people poor. Today, however, the standard criticism of capitalism is that it produces too much stuff. It makes us too preoccupied with the baubles that money can buy, rather than the finer, more nobler and nobler things of the soul.
Does it make us more materialistic, or is it actually making us more virtuous as people?
I would think that it actually makes us, it allows us to be less materialistic. I think you can probably hold human inclinations constant for the better part of history. But a fairly standard, a growing argument, one made by Deirdre McCluskey and also by Steven Pinker, is that we're actually getting better over time. We're becoming less materialistic, less selfish, less prone to violence. The probability that you would die at the hand of another man or woman 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, was much, much, much higher than it is today. Murder was the rule rather than the exception. There's an old proverb, I think, among Germanic peoples. This is quoted, and Mises quotes this in his book Socialism. I think he attributes it to Tacitus. But he says, it seems feckless, nay, even lazy, to acquire by trade that which can be acquired by the shedding of blood. I paraphrase that, but at the height of the Roman Empire, even the returns to be rich was seen as virtuous, but to get rich via commerce was seen as base and common and not honorable.
Very interesting.
Today, however,
you know, the other thing that that strikes me on this argument that Dieter McCloskey makes is that capitalism actually allows us to live longer, and by giving us more time for leisure to pursue artistic pursuits.
Yes, yes, definitely. So we're able to appreciate the arts, first of all. We're able, furthermore, to produce more of the arts.
Sure.
So the artistic output of the modern world is leaps and bounds greater than it has ever been, and in large part that's a result of the wealth and the leisure produced by capitalism.
So not just the choice in physical things that we can purchase, but also the choice in how we allocate our time, our energy, our creativity.
Yeah, exactly. Because in a pre-capitalist world, we had to devote so much time, so much energy, and so much attention just to acquiring enough calories to stay alive that we didn't have time for the arts. We didn't have time for music. We didn't have time for painting. We didn't have time to sit and reflect on what it meant to live a good life because we were more concerned with making it to tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that makes us less materialistic. We are less concerned with the vagaries of the material world than we were 500 years ago, 600 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 25,000 years ago.
Well, but doesn't capitalism also produce all sorts of nasty, degrading things like cigarettes and alcohol and pornography and violent movies and things of that nature?
That's one argument. It's been argued that yes, capitalism gives us a bunch of stuff that preys upon the darker angels of our nature, so to speak, or that orients itself toward our baser intentions. First of all, I'm not entirely convinced that that's completely true relative to the world from which we're emerging. So yes, today we have violent movies, and we have pornography, and we have cigarettes, and we have alcohol, and that's all, and we have a variety of different things that we use to amuse ourselves that we consider awful and terrible and disgusting. But again, if you go back, particularly in the South, you know, 100, 120 years ago, people got their jollies by lynching black people.
Sure.
You know, the fact that today, or some people did, the fact that, and it was considered a form of community entertainment in some places. The fact that we have emerged from that to a world in which people are able to indulge their preferences for violence by watching violent movies, we'll say, I think is an absolute unambiguous improvement in the moral character of the societies that we live in.
Well, this is a very interesting point because, you know, reality is that base activities, if you want to call them that, have always been present.
Yes.
I mean, it's not that they were invented by a capitalist society.
Right.
That, you know, people want what they want, and, you know, without judgment on those particular things, people are going to pursue and obtain those things wherever they can obtain them. But you make a fascinating point that actually, by creating a market, for example, for violent viewing, if you will, you actually create it in such a way that it actually may decrease violent activity. Now, is there any research backing that up?
There is, actually. There was a paper published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics a couple of years ago arguing that violent movies tend to actually reduce real-world violence.
Mm-hmm.
So on the opening weekend of a violent movie, we see small dips in violence. There are a couple of papers, actually, arguing that diffusion of pornography reduces incidents of sex crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where very, very careful economic reasoning is important because we observe often a correlation between two things. Say, for example, people who tend to commit sex crimes also consume a lot of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
People infer from that that the pornography is causing the sex crimes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at least according to the research, the pornography is a substitute for the sexual violence.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I know that there's going to be some families that are going to feel very angry about this kind of a conversation because obviously some people feel that some of these kinds of activities, some video games and so on, actually may have inspired, like the 1999 Columbine Massacre and other things of that nature. And I don't think that's completely inappropriate. In other words,
not at all.
You know, these people, it very well may be that some people derive their inspiration from these things as well. But, you know, at the same time, we're really looking at the macro trends on this
right
thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very difficult. And here we need to tread lightly when we discuss issues like this, particularly if you're dealing with people who've lost loved ones.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Because it's also very easy to extrapolate from one or two or three unique and spectacular events,
right,
and argue that those are indicative of a broader social phenomenon. Now, I don't know if there's much research on, say, violent video games,
right,
for example. But given what I know about the pornography literature and the violent movies literature, I would not be surprised if violent video games are a substitute for, rather than a contributor to, violence more generally.
Right. And I think one of the things that is very difficult for people to keep straight when they get into an emotional issue like this is the difference between correlation and causation.
Right, yeah.
And so, but let's move on here, and let's talk about the next major objection that we come across often, that capitalism destroys the environment. Isn't this true?
Okay, so capitalism destroys the environment. Well, first of all, that depends on how you define the environment.
Well,
and I guess
unfortunately,
the environment here in a minute.
Our current environment is that we have a break coming up, and so I'm going to have to interrupt you right now, Art, and
sure,
we'll come back to this particular question right after we come back after the break. This is Radio Free Market. This is Michael McKay, your host, talking with Dr. Art Carton on common objections to capitalism. Please stay tuned. Thank you very much. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Dr. Art Carton and our special commentator, Zoe Russell. So, Art, we were just talking about, does capitalism destroy the environment? And you were about to answer that question.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions about the relationship between free markets and the environment. And I mentioned a minute ago that a lot of it depends on how you define the environment. If you define it as anything that occurs in nature that's not human, then almost by definition, any human activity results in net environmental degradation, but that's not particularly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
If we're really going to talk about the environment, then presumably we should talk about the natural setting in which human beings exist and live, and this is the really difficult case, I think, for the market. There are a couple of things that go on here. First of all, we see that technological innovation over time, in fact, actually increases environmental quality. So, for example, consider the internal combustion engine,
mm-hmm,
which a lot of people hate today because it belches out horrific, noxious fumes and whatnot. Well, the alternative, particularly in cities about 100 years ago, was not internal combustion, but rather horses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're riding horses in the 19th century, the early 20th century, that sounds wonderful, but one of the things that horses produce a lot of is manure.
Mm-hmm.
Manure that dries out, manure that enters into the ambient air.
Mm-hmm.
So breathing pulverized horse manure is far, far, far worse for you,
mm-hmm,
than breathing automobile exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
The key issue, though, if we're going to talk about the relationship between capitalism and the environment, is not that free markets or that capitalism result in environmental degradation, but that environmental degradation is a response to an absence of capitalist institutions and an absence of free markets. If you look at the biggest polluters in the United States today, they're almost entirely governments. The biggest polluters in the world today are almost entirely, again, governments.
How? In what way?
Well, take for example, the case of the former Soviet Union is one very conspicuous example. Common ownership of natural resources means that no one has an incentive to preserve, conserve, and protect those resources, and everyone has an incentive to try to exploit those as quickly and as rapidly as possible. So there are a lot of places in the former Soviet Union that are just absolute environmental disasters. Today, places that are commonly owned, places that are not private property, are going to tend to have a lot more pollution than places that are private property.
Okay. We have a caller. His name is John. He's calling from Tennessee. John, are you with us?
Hi. I'm one of Dr. Carden's former students at Rhodes.
Is this John Lentz?
Yes.
Hey, John.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Congratulations on the baby. And
Thank you.
I heard that Colt McCoy handed you a late Christmas gift.
A little bit, yeah.
Yourself out of the game. So,
yep.
Okay, well, my question, this is misconceptions about capitalism, right?
Sure.
All right. One thing that I seem to notice is that what's so central to people's thoughts about the economy is they seem to be very focused on the labor aspect of it. You know,
right.
We have labor unions, but to get better wages and working conditions and all that. But the idea of an employer's union to pay out less or to get more from labor would be abhorrent to people.
Right.
We have people upset that their jobs are being shipped overseas and creating funny South Parks about that. But we don't have people understanding comparative advantage or specialization. And I wondered, is this just me being delusional, or am I onto something here, or what?
In what sense? In that people just generally don't understand economics?
Well, and that they have a special bias for the labor side. Rather
oh,
than...
certainly. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, actually, I encourage you and everybody who's listening to either read Brian Kaplan's book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, or download a podcast in which he talks about it, or just look it up online, because he discusses specifically four biases that voters exhibit that give us bad economic policies. And one is exactly that, make work bias, that creating jobs is what's important. But as he points out, you know, if you go back to the 19th century, we were up to our necks in employment. We had employment from sun up to sundown because we worked, you know, we worked primarily in agriculture. And if we didn't break ourselves all day, every day in agriculture, we would, you know, push ourselves to the brink of starvation. He also refers to something that he calls anti-foreign bias. So you mentioned comparative advantage a second ago. And that's something that's very, very difficult for people to understand, is that we're better off when we trade with poor people. We're better off when we trade with foreigners. Drawing an imaginary line that separates the United States from Canada doesn't change the moral quality of the people on either side of those line, of that line, nor for that matter does it change the fact that trade creates wealth.
And trade creates peace as well.
Yes.
So let's go to the next topic here, that the next objection that we commonly hear, and thank you very much, John, for your contribution. I appreciate you very
much
calling in today.
Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
All right, nice to talk to you.
Capitalism is inherently unstable and is prone to recessions. So let's talk about that. What is the where does this concept of capitalism being inherently unstable, and what's the alternative to capitalism anyway?
Well, I think the alternative to capitalism is even greater instability, obviously. And quite honestly, I think the belief that capitalism is inherently unstable just comes from the fact that people want to believe that capitalism is inherently unstable. People don't like the idea that the world will be better off if we just let
people have choices. We're going to have to cut you off right there, and we'll come back right after the break. We have a long segment coming up, folks, so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, with my special commentator, Zoe Russell, and our special guest, Art Cardin. So, Zoe, why don't you pick it up from here?
Well, we can talk about prices. I know that prices are a very important part of the market, a free market. Tell us about how the consumer is the one, by their choice, that sets the price of everything in the marketplace.
Yeah, so this is one of the most fundamental and, I think, important contributions to human knowledge that occurred in the 20th century, and I don't understate that. This begins with Ludwig von Mises' classic essay, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, and continues through Friedrich Hayek's classic essay, The Use of Knowledge in Society, and they argue that the role of a price is basically to collect and disseminate information. Basically, what a price does is it allows for and enables rational economic calculation. It allows for an extended structure of production, and it allows, again, like we said, for the kind of prosperity that we see today. Because one of the fundamental problems that people have to ask is, okay, what's the best use of my time and energy right now? What's the best use of these resources at my disposal? I have a dollar, or I have $2. What should I do? Should I buy a cup of coffee? Should I save it for the future? What should I do with it? Should I consume it? Should I invest it? prices are what tells us, prices are what tell us which uses of resources satisfy consumers' most urgent wants and consumers' most urgent needs.
Okay, so when the government, say, replaces the consumer in something like healthcare or education, that's when
right.
we see all the prices exploding.
Yeah, well excuse me. Well, we see the prices exploding in part because of subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
So subsidies underwrite consumption. And we see also a major divergence between who's doing the consuming and who's doing the paying.
Right.
I read earlier today that for every dollar worth of hospital care that people consume, they only pay about 3 cents out of pocket.
Mm-hmm.
For the entire healthcare system writ large, for every dollar of healthcare people buy, they only pay about 14 cents.
I heard a statistic that the government pays for 60% of the healthcare expenditures.
That does not surprise me.
Right.
That does not surprise me at all. And that's one of the reasons why, costs are exploding. It's because if I can go and get healthcare and have someone foot the bill, then a couple of things happen to my incentives. First of all, I have an incentive to consume more healthcare than I would otherwise, which sounds great. But I also have an incentive to put myself in a position to need more healthcare
mm-hmm.
than I would otherwise.
Right. And then on the other end, the supply is limited. We don't do anything
right.
to increase the supply, so the prices have to...
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, it gets worse. You know, we mentioned at the beginning, we were talking about the differences between a free market and a non-free market. Among the reasons why healthcare is so expensive is because it's so heavily regulated. If you want to be a doctor, you have to have the right licenses and the right this and the right that and the right approval from the right people. If you want to produce a drug, then you have to go through years and years and years and spend hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars getting that drug approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is true that this probably increases the average quality of care, but it means that people have access to less health care than they otherwise would.
Yeah, you talk about health care Hondas.
Right. Yeah. One thing that I find interesting, and this is a particularly vivid point for me as a father now with one child and with another one on the way, it strikes me as odd that we can ask, like I can go down the street and ask anybody I want to for medical advice, and I can implement that advice. I can ask you for medical advice, and you can give me that medical advice, and I can take it. And you can tell me, you know what, that what I ought to do is drink Clorox. You know, that it goes well on cereal. So I do that and I die. Okay? Well, I can't prosecute you, necessarily. But I'm not allowed to pay someone who's not licensed for medical advice. I'm not allowed to pay someone for medical
treatment.
You can ask,
but you can't pay them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's
that's a very interesting point.
Medical advice is something that's okay to give away for free,
mm-hmm.
but it's illegal to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
That strikes me as odd.
Very interesting.
So would you say, aren't there some things that the government just has to regulate? Aren't there some things that the government just has to subsidize, these public goods that wouldn't otherwise be provided on the free market?
Yeah, okay. So there are a couple of cases in which the market allegedly fails. And this is in the provision of public goods, which are goods for which they're called non-rival and non-excludable, meaning that if I consume some of it, it doesn't diminish the amount that's available for everybody else. And non-excludable means that I can't exclude you even if you don't pay for it. And that definitely is a bit of a problem. But almost everything that falls under the public goods definition has at least some characteristics, or on some margin, is going to be rival or is going to be excludable. So, for example, police services can be provided privately in malls, in residential neighborhoods, and in things like that. Externalities exist when the cost or benefits of my actions spill over onto other people. And these can also be internalized, or these can also be mitigated through the court system.
Kind of like how Visa and MasterCard has their own basic claim system.
Right.
If you have a problem with a merchant, you can just say, call up Visa. You don't have to call up the courthouse and sue these people.
Yeah,
you just
exactly.
Contact the dispute department at Visa and MasterCard. They take the money away from the merchant. They send each of you out a form. They arbitrate the disagreement, and they decide in a very private kind of free market way what the decision is going to be, and everybody is bound by that decision.
Yeah, and that I think is an important insight that gets to a question that the caller raised earlier. First of all, law can be provided privately. Enforcement can be provided privately. Lots of firms deal with arbitration. Lots of firms deal with basically the private provision of law and law enforcement. And then the second point is, even if you can construct a theoretical rationale for government intervention, say, for example, externalities, the fact that people generally don't understand economics that well, and the fact that by introducing government, you introduce political incentives, suggests that in many cases, the cure is going to be worse than the disease. So part of my enthusiasm for free markets, it doesn't derive from some naive belief that it's going to produce nirvana or that it's going to produce utopia, but that the problems produced by government intervention are far worse,
in a relative sense. We have a caller. Actually, we have two callers waiting, and so we're going to ask Patrick in Pennsylvania to come on with his question. Pat, are you there?
Hello, Michael.
Yes. Hello, Patrick.
How are you?
Excellent. Happy Saturday.
Well, I'm just enjoying the show, and I wonder if I could just ask Art if you would care to elaborate perhaps a little bit on actually something that I noticed that he answered when John was discussing the extent of expanding capitalism to the world. And this is one thing that I find that when I talk to people, they may say, well, it's all well and good. Yes, America should be a very prosperous country. We do want it, but, gee, we can't allow all the rest of the world to become like us, because look at the pressure that all these people would put on our limited environmental resources. And can you imagine what the cost of oil would be if the Indians and the Chinese and, you know, name it, if they all had cars like we have? And so that's just impossible. We really don't want the rest of the world to become capitalistic. Now, I know this is not right, but it is a difficult question to answer. I wonder if Art could address that.
Oh, sure thing. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And it's an interesting objection to markets. And more broadly, it's an interesting objection to prosperity. First of all, there's an idea that, well, we don't want people to get rich because then they'll catch up to us. But that assumes, first of all, that the world is a zero-sum game, that the global economy is a zero-sum game. And then second of all, that makes me uncomfortable because I'm not better off because there are people who are starving in Africa or Asia or South America, or even for that matter in parts of Memphis. You know, I'm not better off because people are poor. In fact, I'm worse off because people are poor. Now, the second part of that, which says, well, we would completely denude the world of natural resources, is another common objection, but one that I think is incorrect. One of my intellectual heroes is a gentleman by the name of Julian Simon, who unfortunately died in 1998. But he wrote a great book called The Ultimate Resource. It was republished later as The Ultimate Resource 2. You can get parts of it online. And he made the argument that more people means more brains. More brains means more innovation. And over time, this innovation will make it, well, first of all, it will make us better off. And then second, it will reduce the pressure that prosperity puts on natural resources. Because as we see, say, oil prices increase, or gold prices increase, or silver prices increase, people are going to search for substitutes. So people are going to earn, say, high profits by selling oil to the newly prosperous Chinese, the newly prosperous Indians, and the newly prosperous people all over the world. And if this does drive up the price of oil, then what this is going to do is it's going to induce people to search for substitutes. For oil, it's going to induce people to innovate. So Simon made what I think is a very bracing claim, but one with which I agree, that there's no limit on economic growth. There's no limit on our ability to be free and our ability to be prosperous.
That's an exciting proposition. Does that address your question, Pat?
Yes, very good. Thank you, Art.
Very good. Thank you very much for calling in. And we also have a caller from Iowa. Cliff, are you there?
Hello? Chris from Iowa.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chris. Hello.
I wanted to ask if you've ever read Ed Bernays' book, Propaganda.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first
one. Yeah, I didn't catch a lot of that either, Chris. I'm sorry, but our connection is flawed here. There was a Ed Bernays' book, Propaganda, he was asking if you'd read.
I have not, actually.
I have not either.
I would recommend,
if you guys would, it's only like 100 or so pages, but especially the chapter on psychology of public relations. And, you find out that, you just by giving people misconceptions on things, they will begin to, create this negative clout that is just a, an ever-evolving, mass, kind of like a snowball effect that, the more people think it's bad, the more people will call it bad, the more, bad people will end up finding their way around it because they'll think, oh, well, if I hang out in this dark corner the rest of the darkness, chances are I won't get caught. Somebody else will get caught. You don't have to outrun the bear. You just got to outrun somebody else running at, from the bear.
Right. Yeah. That's very interesting. Like I said, I missed the title of the first book. And actually, I just ordered the second book that you mentioned on propaganda, which strikes me, as one of the great virtues of capitalism. That during our conversation, I was able to order a book, and it's important to remember, like you said, sometimes rather than outrunning the bear, we do just kind of have to outrun the person who's one step behind.
Right. Yeah, there's some excellent resources on that, on this dumbing down of America concept, Chris. And thank you very much for your contribution. Appreciate it very much.
Certainly.
Very good. So, Zoe, you were you had another question that you wanted to address to Art on capitalism, some of the more common objections.
Oh, well, I want to know if capitalism is prone to resource monopoly. Tell us how it actually would work in a good way. Defeat the propaganda and tell us how having all of property private would actually protect resources.
Okay, yeah. So how does having private property protect natural resources? Okay, well, a couple of different ways. First of all, capitalism is not prone to resource monopoly because high prices and profits attract entry into the marketplace. They encourage people to seek substitutes, like we said just a minute ago. And then second of all, if we do have a natural resource monopoly, which we're not going to see, it's not necessarily clear that breaking that up by giving people, a monopoly on the use of force is really an appropriate way to solve that proverbial problem. The last thing that's important to remember about environmental issues is that when property is privately owned, people have incentives to try to find ways to manage that property effectively and efficiently. So the reason that we have resources that are terrifically and terribly overexploited is because they're owned commonly, for the most part, or they're unowned at all, and people have the wrong incentives. So it's not so environmental problems are not a problem of private property. They're not a problem of capitalism. They're a problem of the absence of private property and the absence of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked a little while ago about maybe some things are just too important to be left to the market.
Right.
But, this kind of psychology that we hear, why not food? Why not clothing? Aren't they intrinsically basic to our survival?
Well, they are, yeah. And if some things, I don't like the claim that some things are just too important to be left to the market, because that embeds what I think is a very dangerous assumption. And that is that there exists an institutional arrangement which is either comparable to, equal to, or superior to the market in some way, shape, or form. And this is sort of come around full circle. I mentioned the contributions of Mises and Hayek earlier and their arguments about why capitalism works and socialism doesn't. This idea that some things are too important to be left to the market suggests that things can be produced efficiently and distributed equitably in the absence of market mechanisms. And that's absolutely not true. Unfortunately, what we see historically, is in the absence of market mechanisms, in the absence of private property, and in the absence of prices, we get inefficient and inequitable distribution of goods and services. So I would argue the correct thing to say about some of these things like, for example, healthcare, is that they're too important not to be left to the market. You know, we're dealing with my health. We're dealing with my son's health. We're dealing with my wife's health. We're dealing with your health. We're dealing with the listener's health. You know, these are things that if we want to see them produced efficiently, if we want to see as much innovation as we can possibly get, and if we want to see them distributed equitably, then the thing that we need to do is eliminate the interventions that are currently hampering the healthcare system.
Well, we've been talking about how all these different objections to capitalism, and we're coming into another break, but one of the topics that we really want to address isn't capitalism just plain ugly? And so after we come back from the break, we're going to go into that particular question with Art Carden, our special guest today, with Zoe Russell, our special commentator. This is Michael McKay, and you're listening to Radio Free Market. Please stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. And we're back. Thank you very much, folks, for listening. This is Radio Free Market. I am your host, Michael McKay, and we have with us Art Carden, and we're talking about common objections to capitalism. And so we were just talking about this one point over the break, Art. You know, isn't capitalism just plain ugly, or is it really a thing of beauty?
I would argue, I think capitalism is beautiful. I think market exchange, voluntary exchange, is absolutely beautiful. People generally tend to be suspect of capitalism or suspect of markets because they don't have an articulated purpose. You know, when we say socialism, we say, well, the purpose is to create a great society in which we produce a bunch of stuff and have it equitably distributed. And markets don't have an overarching purpose, but they allow people to accomplish their own goals and their own purposes. We had an example of that actually just during the show when a reader called in and made a reading suggestion, and while we're talking, I bought the book online and it's going to be shipped to my office. You know, Jeff Bezos, who was one of the founders of Amazon.com, and all of the people working for him, they have no idea who I am.
Right.
They don't care. The marvel of cooperation that is internet commerce that's going to deliver a book that I ordered from the comfort of my desk to my office is absolutely astounding.
Right, you mentioned recently that your washing machine crapped out. You had to buy one online.
Right. Yeah. We bought a new washing machine recently because and it was delivered. We bought it from the comfort of our living room. these are things that I think are sort of small beauties of the modern world. They allow people. They allow people who don't know each other, and in fact, people who may not even like each other, to cooperate for mutual advantage. And then furthermore, the prosperity that we get as a result of capitalism allows us the luxury of having this conversation. Where, let's see, Zoe's in Texas, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right, I'm in Memphis, you're in Iowa, mm-hmm. and people are listening to us around the country and around the world.
Right.
You know, in no small part as a result of types of capitalist innovation.
Exactly. And, you know, what it really boils down to is more choices.
Right.
And, you know, what we really have to focus on is that fewer choices are the equivalent of a lower quality of life.
Right.
And higher choices, more choices,
right.
with a higher quality of life.
Right.
The choices are always ours.
Yeah,
but when there's intervention that limits our choices, then we can guarantee ourselves that we are going to have a lower quality of life from those fewer choices.
Right.
And
right.
so it's a vitally important concept for people to understand that that choices are available to us because
right.
of the more free, less restricted competition that a free market makes available to us.
Yes. In fact, I would argue it's this ability to make choices. It's the ability to choose. It's the ability to observe the world rationally and say, I'm going to take course of action A rather than course of action B, that is part of the fundamental essence of what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, by expanding choices, by expanding opportunities, by expanding our range of cooperation, we in fact expand the range over which people get to indulge and engage in their human faculties.
Well, thank you very much, Art. I've greatly appreciated both of these shows on the common objections to capitalism and Zoe, your contributions as well. You know, I find this a particularly a polite conversation because people who veto the voluntary choices of others, I personally find repugnant. People should just allow people to peacefully exchange as they will. Beyond that, they should mind their own business. So, folks, please stay with us. Next week we have Dr. Dieter McCluskey, a noted author and economist, the author of Bourgeois Virtues. And I thank you very much for your time. Talk to you again next week. This is Radio Free Market. Michael McKay, your host. Thank you for listening.